From PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and Sandberg Media, LLC, I'm David Dalt with Things Not Seen.
Love, as I said before, is about willing the good of others. And God loves all people. If there are Christian political expressions that do not intend or will the good of others, whether they share Christian beliefs or perspectives or not, then that political action, that behavior is not Christian in its character.
Things Not Seen is made possible in part through the generosity of our Patreon supporters. If you'd like to join them, please go to patreon.com/notseenradio. That's patreon.com/notseenradio. Thank you. Welcome to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're delighted today to welcome to the program Michael Ware. He's the founder, president, and CEO of the Center for Christianity and Public Life, a nonpartisan, nonprofit institution that contends for the credibility of Christian resources in public life for the public good. For well over a decade, Michael Ware has served as a trusted resource and advisor for a range of civic and religious leaders on matters of faith and public life, including as a White House and presidential campaign staffer. Previously, Michael Ware founded and led Public Square Strategies, a consulting firm that helps religious and political organizations, businesses, and others navigate the rapidly changing landscape of religion and politics in America. He's the author of several books. Today, we're talking about his most recent book, The Spirit of Our Politics, Spiritual Formation, and the Renovation of Public Life. Michael Ware, welcome to Things Not Seen.
David, it's wonderful to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start our conversation in a little bit of an odd place. You were working in the White House, and when people wanted to go into conferences in the Oval Office, they oftentimes had to sit outside the Oval Office. And in that space, there was a very particular painting of a young girl named Ruby Bridges. And I wonder if you could start out talking to us about that painting and what that painting said to you about what was going on there in the White House at that time.
Yeah. Oh, what a great way to start this conversation. So it's a Rockwell painting depicting Ruby Bridges, who at 6 years old integrated her Louisiana public school. She, with great protestation, was escorted by federal marshals day after day to her school, which no other students attended. All the white families pulled their kids out of the school. And so she would be escorted by federal marshals, often through crowds of adults, white adults who would scream epithets at her, express their wishes for her death. And she would be escorted to school. An incredible person. By the way, people are often surprised to hear she's still alive. She has a book coming out this year. This is not distant history. This is well within many of our lifetimes. As I discuss in the book, Ruby got the attention of a well-known psychologist and moral theorist by the name of Robert Coles at Harvard, who was so intrigued and really concerned about the psychological pressures that a six-year-old girl who sort of endured this and went through this would face. And he studied her, and I go into great detail in the book, but he, after testing out all of his psychological theories, stumbled in interviews upon the fact that as she was walking through these crowds, she was praying for those who were insulting her. And she had an incredible sense of God's presence and care for her in the midst of that. So Norman Rockwell depicts this scene in this painting. It hung outside the White House, outside the Oval Office. And as you noted, people who would go to meet with the president would often sit on a sofa right under this painting as they were waiting to be escorted into the Oval Office. And the Oval Office is just an incredibly intimidating space. It's an oval for a reason. The door closes and it's like a casino. You can't find a way out. You wonder, am I going to be, I don't think anyone could get to me if they wanted to. And I don't know I could get out if people didn't want me to get out. And so it can be incredibly intimidating. I would see folks in charge of million member organizations, huge budgets, significant profiles start to wilt under the pressure of being on the precipice of walking into the Oval Office. But if you look up, and I know some of these testimonies personally, there are testimonies of people who would look at that painting of 6-year-old Ruby Bridges and the kind of person she was, to not just do what she did, but to do what she did the way that she did it and with the spirit with which she did it, who have these testimonies of saying, if Ruby could do what she did, surely I could represent my convictions and the people I represent and advance what I think is good, even in a pressured situation like what you'd find in the Oval Office with the president. And it's that story to me. There's so much there to unpack. But one thing to say about it are the ripple effects of the behavior and activity and person of someone who has the formation that can hold up in the thick of life. And that was what Ruby, at 6 years old, that's what Ruby had.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're delighted today to be speaking with Michael Ware. He is the founder, president, and CEO of the Center for Christianity and Public Life, a nonprofit, nonpartisan institution that contends for the credibility of Christian resources in public life for the public good. Today, we're talking about his recent book, The Spirit of Our Politics, Spiritual Formation and the Renovation of Public Life. What I really love about what you've given us now about this, both Ruby Bridges, the person, and the poise with which she carried herself at 6 years old, smiling at people who were wishing her evil and even praying for them, but also talking to us about this framing of the Norman Rockwell picture of it. I wanted to start there because to me, that really captures a lot of the structure of what I believe you're trying to do here in your book, The Spirit of Our Politics. And you say right at the outset, you're not trying to contend for a particular political position or outcome, even though you have them. But rather, you're trying to make an argument for not a particular type of political position, but a particular type of character formation among people of faith, particularly people who identify as Christians or who are motivated by the witness of Jesus Christ and those that call themselves Christians. So I wonder if you could talk to me a little bit about, and to my listeners, about the main pieces of character formation you want to make sure are ringing out clearly in your book, The Spirit of Our Politics.
Yeah, well, I think first it's important to say character formation or spiritual formation is not for a special set of people, an elite class of Christians or people will identify as, well, I'm a very spiritual person. And there's a way in which they mean that, but when I talk about spiritual formation, this is something that everyone has their character, their will shaped in a particular way, in a particular direction. And so these are questions that we all, regardless of faith, regardless of background, spiritual formation is something that we all undergo and we are all becoming a certain kind of person. Christian spiritual formation is directed and focused entirely on the person of Jesus Christ. As Christians, we are learning from Jesus how to live our lives as Jesus would live them if he were us. Now, importantly, this is different than simply doing what Jesus did. We are learning from Jesus how to live the lives we have as he would live them if he were us. And so, there are many ways to talk about this. The book is structured to follow a model of spiritual formation that comes from a philosopher teacher by the name of Dallas Willard. Dallas Willard taught at the University of Southern California for many decades. He was chair of the philosophy department for a time, and he had a model of spiritual formation called VIM, vision, intention, means. That's how he believed spiritual formation took place. He believed that was Jesus's sort of model of teaching. And so the book covers vision. What is the vision we have of the world, of reality, of our place in it? What is our intention of how we respond to that reality? And then what are the means that we take up as we see, in terms of Christian spiritual formation, to participate with Jesus in the kind of, in cultivating the kind of character that he is seeking to cultivate in us? These are some of the sort of hallmarks, or what we refer to as the fruit of the Spirit. Things like self-control, things like joy, gentleness, love. And I talk about these things in the book. Just one last note, David, which is, these are not merely private and personal ideas. Spiritual formation is for all of life. There is no political you. There's just you. The kind of person, the kind of people we are in politics or in our businesses or places of work or in our relationships are not cordoned off from the kind of person we actually are. No, actually, the kind of person we are in politics, if you will, in political discussion, berate the person you're speaking with in order to get them, in order to win the argument. That is the kind of person you are. That's not just, oh, well, that's politics. Those are the rules of politics. And so that doesn't really count. In real life, I'm a really wonderful person. No, we have one life and we're living it. And the kind of person we are has much to do with the kind of politics and public life that we have.
Well, and I really appreciate you bringing out these elements. And I want to ask you specifically about this, because it is clear that you have an anthropology at work here. And I'm going to say it back to you and see if I've got it. One thesis of your anthropology is people are coherent. As you were just saying, a person who is Machiavellian in their political life is a Machiavellian person in their life, because you can't split off into these fractured notions of the self. The other thesis is that every human being is spiritual and has a spiritual, a non-material dimension that must be considered in our interactions with them. Now, as I say these two things back to you, have I got it basically right? Would you say it in a different way? Would you add anything to what I'm giving you here?
Yeah, I think that's basically right. I think with the first point, what I'd say is there are people who have, and I think this is actually a pretty dominant thing, there are people who believe in a sort of private morality. And so they may apply certain characteristics to their personal lives that they wouldn't apply to their public behavior. And so there can be different expressions in different spheres of life, but that constitutes the whole person. And so I could imagine someone who would operate in a Machiavellian manner in politics, that because of their conception of reality and where something like love your enemies is realistic, operating in a different way in another sphere of life. But just because it's another sphere of life doesn't mean that you're not the same person, or that some spheres of life sort of don't count as the real you. The other thing I just say is I do find that it's very difficult to quarantine off particular logics from affecting the whole person. If you're willing to excuse certain kinds of behavior when the heat is really on in politics, then that logic very easily creeps into when the heat is on in other areas of your life. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Michael Ware. He's the founder, president, and CEO of the Center for Christianity and Public Life, a nonpartisan, nonprofit institution that contends for the credibility of Christian resources in public life for the public good. Today, we're talking about his recent book, The Spirit of Our Politics, Spiritual Formation and the Renovation of Public Life. We'll be back in just a moment.
Things Not Seen is brought to you in part by Liturgical Press. Liturgical Press is a trusted publisher of resources on liturgy, scripture, theology, and spirituality. They've evolved to serve the changing needs of the Christian church, and they produce resources for pastoral leaders, teachers, engaged learners, and all leaders looking for quality books on faith and culture. Lit Press books are available at your favorite book retailer and online at litpress.org. That's litpress.org.
Welcome back to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. If you're enjoying these conversations, please go to our website, thingsnotseenradio.com. There you'll find more than 10 years of these sorts of interviews and conversations, all available for free for your listening pleasure. We're delighted today to be speaking with Michael Ware. He's the founder, president, and CEO of the Center for Christianity and Public Life, a nonpartisan, nonprofit institution that contends for the credibility of Christian resources in public life for the public good. Today, we're talking about his most recent book, The Spirit of Our Politics, Spiritual Formation and the Renovation of Public Life. Well, as we have been talking about these ideas of spiritual formation, and as we have been talking about the notion of a coherent person who is a spiritual person, I was also really helped in your book, The Spirit of Our Politics, by some of the analytical lenses that you brought to the question of politics. And in particular, that there are some people, both on the left and on the right, who engage with politics as if it is a sport, or as if it is a kind of entertainment. And that really skews the effect, both for those voters that are in the middle, but also for politicians. And I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about this dynamic of extremity that you lay out so carefully in your book.
Yes. So one of the ways in which I approach this is using the term political hobbyist, which comes from a wonderful political scientist and Tufts, Eitan Hersh. And Hersh advances this term in his book, Politics is for Power, which is a really great and wonderful book. And a political hobbyist is essentially the kind of person who is spending a lot of time consuming political content, who would think in their mind, I'm highly politically engaged, but they never actually participate in politics itself. They're not actually engaged in the project of self-governance. Their political engagement is the consumption of political entertainment. They are the kind of people who will spend hours on Reddit chains and debating people online. It can be a kind of performative and identitarian sort of political affinity, but it's not engaged in power building. This is politics as a consumeristic activity. And I find that this has a lot of overlap with a study that came out from the Knight Foundation, and more in common, they call it the hidden tribes. And what this research found was that our politics is dominated by about 14% of Americans on the extreme sides of the spectrum that are highly engaged, that have highly polarized views, and that take up a lot of the oxygen in our politics without reflecting the vast majority of Americans' views. And so you put these ideas together and you begin to get a picture of a politics that is dictated by a set of affinities, a kind of onlineness that is detached and removed in large measure from the actual work of politics, of self-governance. And this is a profound problem for our politics right now, that you actually have political conversations dictated by people who largely have no interest in getting anything done, who are detached from the actual work of politics. And I think we see the ramifications of this across our political life.
I'm so grateful for that answer and for your introducing this idea from Eitan Hersh, particularly the title of his book, Politics is for Power. I want to dig a little deeper into that, because I think in our contemporary conversations, whether academic or out in the kind of pundit arena, we tend to collapse power together with constraint and violence and coercion. And I'm thinking of a little book by Hannah Arendt called On Violence, where Arendt splits those out and says, no, no, no. Where violence and coercion is present, we actually see a diminution of power, a diminution of the actual coalition building that you're talking about in politics. So I wonder if I say to you, you know, that I'm compelled by Arendt here, how do you think of this distinction that Arendt makes here between violence and power?
Yes. I mean, one way to think about this is through the exceptional decline in institutional trusts. And so you have a great cynicism and skepticism about these institutions that are power-wielding institutions. And yet, these institutions continue to operate necessarily. And so what happens when you have an expectation of the cynical use of power actually feeding into and incentivizing those in decision-making positions? So, for instance, Pew put out a study in the last few months showing the general expectation among Americans is that elected officials are there for their own self-interest, not out of a sense of service. Well, that expectation means that our elected officials have to respond, have to act in response to that expectation. And it can help to, and I think, again, we're seeing this in our politics today, a politics that is robbed of even the imagination that it could be a place for service allows for the misdirection of power towards things like self-interest, things like harm. One concept we haven't talked about yet is that of political sectarianism, which frames so much of this book. And just very briefly, political sectarianism is a term that was advanced by a number of social scientists in 2020 that defines a particular kind of polarization we have today. The academics said that we basically have a toxic cocktail of three ingredients: an aversion towards those that we politically disagree with, the tendency to other those in the opposing political party or those that we disagree with politically, and then a misplaced moralization. So the kind of heightening of political disagreement to a matter of sin or iniquity, a pure good versus evil fight. What happens? This is a rhetorical question. What happens when you combine tremendous cynicism about the work of politics with an approach to politics that is fueled by aversion, othering, and a misplaced moralization? And the academics were exactly right. It's a toxic cocktail that not just undermines and leads to destructive outcomes in terms of governance, but what my book is also concerned with is how it affects our communities, our churches, our own families, and the ways in which dysfunction at the community level and at the personal level is feeding into politics, and then the way that a corrosive political culture exacerbates that dysfunction even further is, again, not just a political crisis, but a societal one.
Well, and I want to stick with this for a moment because, and you highlight this very well in your book, The Spirit of Our Politics, there has been a temptation for American Christianity, both on the right and on the left, to say, well, in this particular case, the stakes are so high, the outcome is so potentially bad that we will abandon the kind of soft messaging of Christianity, love thy neighbor, because we've got to get stuff done now. And I wonder if you could comment on that increased urge to abandon the core narratives of Christianity for the sake of a kind of expediency or a kind of getting things done in the political arena.
Yeah. So what I want to contend here is that the soft thing is actually to give up, to say, oh, this, it is too difficult to hold to these core commitments given the circumstance. That's the soft thing, not the hard thing. I think we are so often distracted by the belligerence that some people bring to the public square, we confuse it for certainty and for confidence. But what I actually want to say to your point is that the belligerence that we see in public life in the kinds of expressions that you're seeing here is not an expression of confidence. It's actually an expression of deep, profound insecurity. I think there's this idea that some of the worst expressions of Christianity in public right now are because these people believe things too deeply. They need to loosen their hold on their convictions. And what I want to suggest is that no, the belligerence is the loosening of the hold. The belligerence is people saying like, this just doesn't work. If I don't secure what I need right now, I don't have a future. Now, the Christian faith offers tremendous resources for assuring people and giving people resources to draw on that allows them to look to a future, that allows them to engage in all of life with hope and joy and love. And love, of course, is the willing of the good. So the love of God and the love of neighbor, the willing of the good for others in our public life, this insecurity, this sense of threat, the sense of embattlement, this sense of this is all there is, that is both a very counter to the central understandings of the Christian faith. And then we see that played out in our public life in ways that are destructive to the extent, David, that right politicians go into churches or as President Trump did, stand up at the National Prayer Breakfast after Arthur Brooks, a conservative former head of the American Enterprise Institute, referenced and gave a talk on loving your enemies. And what did President Trump do? He got up and he said, look, I know you Christians, of course, I'm paraphrasing here. He said, I know you Christians have this love your enemy stuff, but let me tell you, in politics, that ain't going to work. You're going to get steamrolled if you try that stuff in politics. And so, sure, try that in your personal life. But let me take care of things in the political realm so that maybe you can try out this Christian stuff in your homes and that kind of thing. And that logic is, again, tremendously harmful to society. It's also a death knell to Christian spiritual formation.
Michael Ware, what I love about the answer that you just gave me is that you drew us back to an earlier part of our conversation, because now we're seeing in practice the fracturing of coherence that you warned us about. Because when a Christian enters the political arena and following perhaps the impetus of someone like Donald Trump says, well, in this particular moment, these values will no longer work for me because I've got to get stuff done. That begins to be the fracturing, the notion that somehow I can be one thing in the political arena and something else in my personal life. So I really like that you're drawing us back and showing us that. And one of the places that really this shined for me was you began to bring Dietrich Bonhoeffer into the conversation at this point. And I wonder if you could tell us how Bonhoeffer helps us think about coherence in public life and in public action.
I love the question. I think this is one of the most helpful ideas in the book. And of course, it's not from me. I'm relaying an idea that Bonhoeffer proposes in his book, Life Together. Bonhoeffer has this incredible notion. He says, what Christians meet, they never meet one-on-one. They are always mediated by, and always standing between them is Jesus. Now, this is just a tremendously important concept. If Christians approached public life with the idea that they are never acting directly on public life, they are never responsible solely for outcomes in our politics, but they are looking to Jesus and is seeking, what is Jesus trying to do with this person? What is Jesus seeking to do in this circumstance? It would provide the distance and perspective for Christians to enter politics and participate in politics, not as has so often been the case, as an act of imposition, but instead in a spirit of loving service. This idea from Bonhoeffer is so tremendously critical. Now, I do want to say, right? So Bonhoeffer is talking here about relations between Christians. Yeah. So for folks who are not Christian listening to this, you might say, I don't know what Jesus is trying to do with me, but I don't want any part of it. I think one thing I want to say is that what we need to understand is that love is not merely a feeling or a sentiment. Love, as I said before, is about willing the good of others. And God loves all people. If there are Christian political expressions or Christian expressions in any area of life that do not intend or will the good of others, whether they share Christian beliefs or perspectives or not, then that political action, that behavior is not Christian in its character. And so the other thing I'd want to say connected with that is this idea that we procedurally get our way around the kind of people we are. T.S. Eliot has this great quote. He says, the human endeavor has been to try to create a system so perfect that people no longer have to be good. And I just want to say that's a failing notion. So for people listening to this and go, no, can't they just leave this faith stuff outside of politics, that there are important legal protections around the separation of church and state? And I think those should be, as Dallas Willard wrote, zealously upheld. But what I think we're seeing the failing of is this idea that these legal protections will somehow help us evade the character of the people. And you can't separate out faith from the character of people of faith. Like, these questions just have to be contended with. And if we don't contend with them, then what ends up happening is we end up having these sort of procedural debates that actually skirt around the core questions of what we're doing in our politics and public life. And again, I think we've run that course and found that actually this strategy of evasion is not serving us too well.
As we're moving towards our next break, your answer has me thinking of a short statement by a Catholic cardinal from Africa, Cardinal Robert Serra. And a couple of years ago, he said, it's not the role of the church to listen. It's the role of the church to teach. And there are some people who have this view that we have the truth, and therefore we just have to push all the political levers to get everyone to accept the truth by any means necessary. So I want to ask you, as we're moving towards our next break, what is the role of listening here in your conception of politics?
Oh, yeah. I don't know how you can teach without listening. We are involved and invested in a project of self-governance. And in order to respect that project, in order to respect the dignity of the people that we are seeking to govern with, there has to be a respect and attentiveness to the variety of concerns and perspectives within our body politic. Again, I think this mode of political engagement, whether it comes from a religious perspective or not, of brute imposition, self-interested mobilization, is one of the great forces that undermines a positive vision for a politics of service. And unless we regain an imagination, now, of course, this isn't going to mean that we're all going to agree on what is the common good. It doesn't mean we're all going to agree on whether a policy proposal is within the interest of all people, duly considered. But what worries me is, again, this loss of imagination. That could even be something that we're aiming for, that at best, it's a rhetorical veneer through which you just force your own self-interest and pretend like it's something else. And that's what we need to avoid. And so, yes, this listening is the only way by which you can gain and pursue an other-centered politics, which has to be the future of a healthy democracy, if that's what we're going to build.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Michael Ware. He's the founder, president, and CEO of the Center for Christianity and Public Life, a nonpartisan, nonprofit institution that contends for the credibility of Christian resources in public life for the public good. Today, we're talking about his recent book, The Spirit of Our Politics, Spiritual Formation and the Renovation of Public Life. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. Each week on our program, we bring you a rich conversation about culture and faith. If you're enjoying these conversations, please go to our website, thingsnotseenradio.com. There you'll find more than 10 years of these sorts of interviews and conversations, all available for free for your listening pleasure. Today, we're talking with Michael Ware. He's the founder, president, and CEO of the Center for Christianity and Public Life, a nonpartisan, nonprofit institution that contends for the credibility of Christian resources in public life for the public good. Today, we're talking about his recent book, The Spirit of Our Politics, Spiritual Formation and the Renovation of Public Life. Well, I want to continue to think with you and with Dietrich Bonhoeffer here. And so in our previous segment, you talked about how Bonhoeffer really cautions us, and I'm going to do my best to reflect your words here, to distance and perspective, to not enter politics as an act of imposition, but in a spirit of loving service. And what I hear in that phrasing is a balance between a kind of moral conviction and what we might call epistemic humility, which is a fancy way for saying, I can't know everything about this situation. Now, how is a person to really live that balance? What sorts of things can a person be doing so that they're not abandoning their deep moral convictions, but they're also not acting like a juggernaut, imposing them and demanding that they be imposed? Help us understand how we walk that tightrope.
Yeah, so I actually think politics is one of the areas of life in which it can be most obvious that humility is necessary, in a way that if we can take on this posture in politics, it will actually help build up the muscle for us to do this in other areas of life. So in the book, I talk about how politics is not ultimate, but penultimate, how it's not a pure translation of ultimate values, but it is instead credential, that the second you enter into politics, you're in the translation business, not the stenography business. I talk about the contingencies of politics. If you look at the history of public policy, even just think about your own personal history, the history of public policy is one of unintended consequences, and also the coming to understand that even the intentions you felt most convicted about in politics turned out to be the wrong intentions. There are people who have spent decades pursuing one public policy goal. They get it. And within a year, they understand, this didn't turn out the way I had planned. And so it should be easier for us to understand, we need to hold these things lightly in politics because of everything I just mentioned. The difficulty is it is in the short-term interest and certainly seems to be the current approach and currency of politics to actually try to build up certainty and to try and treat politics as a pure, unmediated expression of identity. And when we view politics in this way, when we view our political parties not as vehicles for mediating difference, but as brands, as identitarian brands, which we absorb and follow wherever they may lead, that works in the short-term interest of political. Political parties very much want you to think that your convictions lie in what they prescribe, because then they could change what they prescribe. And if you're a member of the party, you'll just follow along. But look at, all you need to do is read the party platforms on an issue like trade. Well, today, and just 20 years ago, what's 20 years? 20 years is not, and you'll find drastically contrasting approaches. And so this idea that our political parties are these coherent, static ideologies. No, political parties themselves are mediating difference from within themselves. So to get our identities from political parties, that is a shaky foundation. And so, politics can actually be an area of cultivating humility that can then be taken into what I think are more difficult areas of life to cultivate humility, because politics is an area of life in which it should be very apparent that we don't have control over the outcomes. Like, we can convince ourselves that I have the control over the outcome of how my business runs, or what my test scores are going to be. It could be easy to delude ourselves on that front. But in politics, it should be very apparent. I only have limited influence. I'm trying to steward the best way I know how, but the outcomes are not mine. And that should provide, again, a loosening of the hands around our political convictions, which we should have. We just shouldn't make gods of them.
So I'm very grateful for this answer, Michael Ware, because you've begun to draw us back to the question of sectarianism. And I want to reintroduce some categories that you gave us earlier in the conversation: aversion, othering, and moralizing. I want to focus on that last one, moralizing, because in a lot of Christian anthropologies, and I'm thinking particularly from the Reformation traditions, there is a sense of total depravity, that we are in our natures corrupt and corrupted by the fall, however you look at that narrative from the first chapters of Genesis. And I want to take this question of moralizing into a phrase that you have used repeatedly in our conversation: self-governance. How does the Christian balance the notion of total depravity, that we are sinful creatures, with the notion that we could possibly govern ourselves? Help me think about that.
Yeah, what a great question. Dallas Willard was once asked if he believed in total depravity, and he responded that he believed in sufficient depravity. Which I really, really like that answer. Look, it is what is odd about the time we're in is that you have rock bottom levels of trust in government. You have great skepticism and in places an aversion towards our fellow citizens. And you would think that all these and other factors that I haven't named or that we've talked about previously, these should be the conditions for a humility in politics. And instead, even though there's cynicism about politics itself, there's a skepticism towards our fellow neighbors that seems to have only, for many, reaffirmed their own rightness, their own. So there's a very low view of our institutions and of our neighbors, a high view of our own point of view. And I think we again need to have a bit of perspective here. What are the odds that we are the only ones who have figured it out? And if only everyone would follow our political perspective, then this would all be solved. And we at some point we need to contend with the fact that we're all imperfect, that we have something to learn from our neighbors. We have something to learn from our shared history. And that posture of learning, as you brought up, this posture of listening, won't perfect our political opinions, won't perfect our politics, but it will, if we allow it, start to rebuild some sense of trust that we're in this project of self-governance together, as opposed to self-governance being about what is the least amount of consensus I need to build in order to get my way. And that is very much how our political parties are operating now. And frankly, how so many view politics, which is an area of life for conquering and defeating as opposed to serving.
And this really, your notion of service just now, I want to stick with that, because we talked earlier in the conversation about a kind of hobbyist politics or politics as entertainment. And I think a lot of people, and you name this so well in your book, The Spirit of Our Politics, that a lot of people scroll through what used to be called Twitter, or they're on Facebook, and they get mad and they make a comment and they think that they've done a politics. So I really want to ask you, let's assume that we have, in our conversation, inspired listeners to pick up your book. And that once they have read your book, The Spirit of Our Politics, they have been inspired now to get involved in the political process. What does that look like concretely? Does that, are you advocating for them to go out and get on a picket line? Should they start writing a letter? Should they pick up a phone and call their representative? What does this look like concretely for a person who has been motivated by what we've been saying here to get involved in politics?
Yeah, so it could involve all of those things. I think that, so a few things. There's individual engagements. There's, yes, you could attend local school board meeting. You can attend city council hearing. You can contact your representative at various levels. You can donate to campaigns and organizations that are advancing perspective and priorities that you think are in the right direction. I think that there are communal ways to get involved through partnering with friend group and participating in the life of institutions. These are all, so the book provides both practical ways to get involved with politics, as well as practices that can help form you so that when you are engaging in politics, you are the kind of person who is capable of making a positive contribution. And both of those things are necessary. And so yeah, I think there is, in my time in politics in the White House, there are all sorts of structural impediments, right, to our political process. And it's very important that we attend to those structural impediments, that we increase voting access, that we provide more participatory forms of government. But I have to say, I also saw, even under current restrictions and current sort of impediments, the power that an individual or group of individuals can have at affecting even the highest levels of government, which leaves out the enormous impact that people can have in their local communities and local forms of government, which are much more responsive for obvious and I think helpful reasons. And so it is possible that I think what it takes in large part is the character to not just withstand, but to start to turn back some of the harmful incentive structure and logic that dominates so much of political participation. It's the only way our politics is going to get better. Again, I think this idea that we can remain to be the same kind of people and our politics is going to get better separate from the nature of the incentives that we're providing to our politics is a misguided notion. There's not going to be a perfect one-to-one translation. Again, there are structural impediments. But if you think that ways in which our politics reflects the state of the character of the American people now, if you think that there's a negative sort of effect there, the suggestion is that there can be a positive effect, that actually we can do good in politics. It doesn't just have to be about mitigation. And that's the vision I'm trying to point people towards in this book.
As you were starting out this book, The Spirit of Our Politics, I imagine that you and your editors had a vision for what the book would be and what it would accomplish. Now that you're on this side of the book, it is out, it is coming into the world, and you're beginning to talk about it. Did the writing of the book confirm your thoughts at the beginning of the process, or did something shift for you in the process of writing this book? And if so, what shifted and how?
It is such a great question. I think what became really clear to me as I moved through the book was how disheartened people are, how disempowered people feel. And one of my hopes for the book is that it provides a way of thinking about politics and participating in politics that draws on resources that come from outside of our politics. I think there's such cynicism for good reason about our politics now, but we're in a death loop of looking to a politics that we no longer have confidence in to create its own solutions. And what I think is actually we need a contribution from outside of our political logic if we are to reform our politics, that our politics needs a new stream of water flowing into it. And this book, hopefully, I think, provides a vernacular, a set of practices that are capable of providing that new kind of imagination that our politics and public life and people individually just so desperately, I think, it need. The season that lies ahead of us, I know a lot of people are dreading the presidential election. I want us to get a vision for what it can look like, what the opportunities are in this season for us to get better as people, for our politics to improve, that is not solely determined by politicians themselves and by political outcomes. What does it look like to build up the kind of reservoir that can resource our public life, not just through November, but what are we building that will last beyond November? And that is something that we can look toward that is not a withdrawal from our politics. I think folks should be involved in thinking about the presidential election. But if our imaginations are solely limited by what happens in a presidential election cycle, we're going to be starving our politics and even our presidential election of the kinds of resources it needs to resource our public life in the way it needs to be resourced.
Well, Michael Ware, your book, The Spirit of Our Politics, is a tour de force. In reading it, you gave me really just good handholds of analysis that I could begin to apply in my own thinking about political life, both locally and nationally. But also, you introduced me to some figures that I knew the names of, but I didn't know the complexities of their thinking, particularly Dallas Willard. I want to thank you on behalf of my listeners for the effort and time it took to write this book. But thank you especially for talking with me and my listeners about it today.
It was great to be with you. Thank you so much, David.
We've been speaking today with Michael Ware. He's the founder, president, and CEO of the Center for Christianity and Public Life, a nonpartisan, nonprofit institution that contends for the credibility of Christian resources in public life for the public good. For over a decade, he has served as a trusted resource and advisor for a range of civic and religious leaders on matters of faith and public life, including as a White House and presidential campaign staffer. Today, we've been talking about his recent book, The Spirit of Our Politics: Spiritual Formation and the Renovation of Public Life. Things Not Seen is produced by Sandberg Media, LLC. We're distributed nationally by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Today's show was recorded at the William Adams Studios in beautiful Hyde Park here on the south side of Chicago, Illinois. Our theme music is composed by Gene Kija. Our show is made possible in part by the generosity of supporters on Patreon. You can find out how to help us create great programs by going to patreon.com/notseenradio. You can follow us on Twitter at @notseenradio. Visit us on Facebook and like our page to receive regular updates about the show and find out more about our guests. That's facebook.com/thingsnotseenradio. And you can sign up for the free podcast, listen to old shows, send us an email, and find out more about our guests if you visit us on the web at thingsnotseenradio.com. I'm David Dalt, and we'll be back next week with more conversations about culture and faith. Please join us.